You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, or Free Radio Santa Cruz.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
There's a struggle taking place everywhere on this planet to maintain a social hierarchy that gives some everything they desire, by robbing from others the chance to live dignified and fulfilling lives, or even to live at all. This battle has many fronts, and its outcome touches everyone. Yet it is taboo to examine its workings, and illegitimate to question its rightness. So, that's exactly what we're going to do tonight. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary.
I never took food from the widows and orphans, and never a hard-working man I oppressed. So take your pace easy, go home soon like lightning. We soon will be riding my shiny black.
Daily newscast on television networks, where most Americans now get their news, were regularly to cover, for example, poor families being evicted from their homes so that the property could be redeveloped as homes for wealthy people. What if the news media reported daily on the effects that manufacturing plants moving to low-wage countries had on working people and communities in America and in the countries where they now operate? What if they broadcast documentary series on union organizing drives at American corporations? If such stories as I listed in my example took the place of detailed coverage of celebrity sex scandals or blow-by-blow descriptions of sports games and who won or lost, how would this affect what people in this country thought about and applied their energies to? A celebrity rapist, or the growing lines at food banks, are equally news events. Yet somebody gets to make the decision what to report on and how to frame it. It's not a question of bias or absence of bias. All news is biased, starting with a decision on what to cover, and then on how to cover it. The real question is how and why we get a certain bias and not another. Those who control what gets reported on often deny there is any bias operating in their editorial decisions, but that of a desire to present what interests the audience. Is that true? Or rather, what audience is being served? And what audience is being served up? In 1996, Randy Baker and Bess Sanders produced a documentary film, Fear and Favor in the Newsroom, that sheds light on just these issues. Mike McCormick spoke recently with the filmmakers about their film and the application of its ideas to the current movement for media reform.
What is the basic idea behind Fear and Favor in the Newsroom, and when did you come up with the idea to produce it?
Well, Fear and Favor is an hour-long documentary, and it's a series of case studies of self-censorship in the American press. And the way we got the idea to do it is a prior documentary I had done, which was called Making the News Fit, and that was on press coverage of the war in El Salvador. And we interviewed, or I interviewed, a New York Times reporter whose front page story of the 1982 elections was completely rewritten by New York, and it was rewritten for political ideology. what he wrote didn't fit what New York wanted to portray that was going on in El Salvador. And I thought, well, you know, if this is happening at the New York Times, which they have all this prestigious integrity of their journalistic standards, then what's happening in other news organizations? And that's what we started to look at.
I just want to add, it's an important background, I think. The 1982 elections were sponsored by the United States, and they purportedly showed that El Salvador was a democracy, and so it was appropriate for us to fund the government side in the Civil War. And what the New York Times reporter's story really showed was the death squads were still running all over the country, so the left couldn't participate in the elections. The left was the other side of the Civil War. So the elections weren't really democratic, and his story got rewritten to basically conceal that argument.
All right. And then when you started moving on the project and lining up interviews, were you surprised by what you discovered?
Not really. But what was a challenge was to get reporters to speak frankly about what their experience had been. I mean, basically all the reporters that we got to go on camera, with the exception of probably one, their journalistic career, in all intents and purposes, is over with. If they were on the fast track, they're no longer on the fast track. You know, they are now in smaller papers in areas that are not going to ever... they're not going to make a big dent in their journalistic rise to fame and fortune.
And these were not, you know, second-tier players. I mean, four of them had Pulitzer Prizes. They had Emmy Awards. They had won Polk Awards, which is for broadcast journalists the equivalent of a Pulitzer. So these guys were, you know, pretty well at the top of their game before they got into trouble with their bosses.
And what was the summation of, for those that haven't seen your fine documentary yet, what was the summation of things? Was it across the board that this is happening, that there's this influence?
Well, things have shifted. It depends on the editorial leadership of a given organization, and sometimes that shift. Like Sidney Shambert said, he was free to write in the New York Times in the 60s and 70s. The kinds of stories that he was encouraged to write were questions about what's happening with the have-nots. That became a taboo in the late 80s, and then he resigned after a period of time.
Well, they took away his column after he said unflattering things about the relationship of the New York Times and the local media to big business and to some kind of, a freeway project that the local real estate interests were supporting, and Shanberg criticized the media and implicitly the Times as well, and for going along with it, and they took away his column for that.
But all these journalists were... true believers. They thought their job was to uncover the information that people needed to have a free discussion about public policy. And the trend, like for Frances Serra, who was also at the New York Times, she was encouraged to do news that you can use. Stories like how to read your heating bill, trends in lifestyle issues. And that's not at all what she had been trained at the Columbia Journalism School. I mean, she was the reporter who wanted to do the investigative reporting that really got to the heart of the matter. And that's the kind of stuff that over time she realized that this was not being encouraged. And then she did stories that were basically, they were spiked completely. So, I mean, over time, she got the message quite clearly, and then her career ended. And I think the interesting thing about this documentary is hearing what people said, how they got that message, that you've stepped over a line. And they all, if you ask all these different journalists, well, how did you know when you'd crossed the line? And they were pretty amusing, and they all came up with very similar things. Well, you know, that story is going to be hard. You know, you don't have enough time to do that. Or what else have you got on your plate? You know, they're all the ways that anyone in an institution has to figure out what are the values, what are the important things in that institution. And if you work in an insurance agency, I mean, it's the same kind of, you have to be in tune to what your boss wants if you're going to advance. And what what happened for these journalists is that they had to confront an institutional environment that contradicted their journalistic integrity.
And I'd add, it contradicted the official portrait that the institutions painted of themselves. You know, CBS, the New York Times, our major news media, you know, more or less have the implicit motto, without fear or favor, which is where our documentary title comes from. And so what these journalists, you know, found was, well, that explicit statement of policy isn't entirely true. And so I think what we tried to do was show this kind of fuzzy area, which is very powerful in shaping American journalism. It does constrict it into a pro-corporate direction. But on the other hand, it's fuzzy in the sense that it's not true to say that the corporate press never reports unflattering or discrediting information about corporations. That's just false. Everyone knows it's false. You can pick up the paper, and almost every day you'll find some stories like that. I think what exists and what we show is there's really a double standard for news in the U.S. There's one standard of, you know, to use Ben Bagdikian's phrase, who's the one of the journalists we use, a former dean of the Berkeley School of Journalism. There's one standard of drama and documentation for stories that don't include discrediting information on corporations and the corporate elite. Then there's another standard for those that do, and it's higher. It's tougher. And so what happens is reporters learn, generally don't go near these stories unless they cross this higher threshold. The reporters we interviewed were the ones who just used one standard. Is this interesting? Can we prove it? And they found out if you apply the same standard to all stories, then you get in trouble.
So this is the policies that are coming from the editorial boards of these different news organizations. And where is the editorial board getting their coaching from? Is that the big owners of these different organizations?
Well, it's great. Some of the people, it's from the owners, but it's not coaching. It's several of the journalists we talked to discuss, what's going on? Where does this line come from? And they put it in terms of, these are the people they have lunch with. These are the people they socialize with. You don't want to, be going to the club and your paper's running some terrible discrediting things about other people in the club. That's not appropriate. And so, it's not appropriate in kind of this social sense of the word. And what happens is, the people who are given high editorial positions in papers, generally are members of the club or people who sort of see the world the way the members of the club do. So there's not a punishment going on. Think about it. If you hired Pat Buchanan as your editor, you wouldn't have to be flogging Pat Buchanan to tell him, we don't want a lot of unflattering information about corporate America. He's with you. That's how he sees things, and that's how people get hired. And it's not even sinister, in the sense that I think the people doing the hiring don't believe they're doing anything wrong. It's sort of natural. You hire people who you think have a good handle on things, and it just so happens that the people who own the media see the world generally the same way, and it's a pro-corporate way.
And I think that's the kind of explanation for why Rush Limbaugh, who had the same kind of ratings as Hightower on their radio shows back Rush Limbaugh got promoted all over the place, and we know what the result is. Whereas Jim Hightower, his show got canceled, even though on the ratings, who they were reaching, how many people in the audience were listening to him, equivalent in their early part of their career.
Interesting. Well, speaking of careers, when did you finish production of Fear and Favor? When did it hit
the airwaves? And
well, we were fortunate to finish the show at a PBS station, a renegade PBS station in San Jose, and they gave us editing facilities and an editor to finish it because we couldn't finance the last leg of the production. It was we were wringing blood out of a rock, and the rock came up dry. So it was a long struggle to get it finished. And when we did that editing with the PBS station, they then took it and had the right to market it to the PBS stations across the country. And so it was finished in 1996, and then it took a year of negotiations with PBS to actually feed it through one of its satellite feeds across the country, and it was given free to all the PBS stations. But it was they have like three different satellite feeds, so we were on the bottom of the food chain, the one that doesn't have high promotions or fit within the budgets of a local station. You know, it wasn't the must-buy kind of product, and we had to promote it with station by station and use grassroots organizing to help promote the airing of it on station by station.
But for instance, for local here in Seattle, KCTS 9 would be our PBS affiliate. Would a station like that have to have paid anything to show that?
No, but in terms of like, it still costs them money to put any kind of a show up. I mean, it didn't cost them out of pocket to buy it. But, you know, they have their budgets and they have to figure out how they're going to allocate those funds. And PBS, I mean, the station here, they were one of the later ones to broadcast it, but in the meantime, a citizen vagrant, which was an activist group, was harassing them repeatedly. And by the time they actually aired it, they did really well with us. They promoted on an on-air clip. They featured it in their news magazine, and I think it got a decent rating. It also was reviewed in both newspapers and got received very good reviews, which it's pretty remarkable now, reading the newspapers. Very few standalone documentaries get that kind of attention, and I attribute it to the grassroots effort.
So, and were you local residents at the time, or were you?
Yeah, at that point we had lived in the Bay Area, and we moved back to Seattle.
So you think that helped with the little club
buildings? No, I don't think so.
So it doesn't sound like productions like this, not only is it independent, but it obviously, you know, slaps the face of corporate media, do very well, even in a situation like trying to go out through venues like PBS and or other independent venues, what other places besides PBS would you put out a documentary like Fear and Favor in the Newsroom?
Well, I mean, it's being shown in universities. That it's done very well there. Occasionally, progressive organizations see value to it and use it as a fundraiser or whatever. And, you know, the Society for Professional Journalists has shown it, even though their journalists don't cover it when they attend their own showings. Perhaps they're not allowed to. But public broadcasting in the U.S. is... although it's not owned, public broadcasting, by that I mean PBS and the PBS affiliate stations around the country, although they're not privately owned, they are largely privately funded. And even though individual viewers who might only be paying, you know, $50 or $100 a year or something, give them a lot of money, maybe even a majority of the money, a very important part of their money and their boards come from large corporations. They, as a result, are very hostile to documentaries like ours. Again, it's, you know, the fact is, you know, when the community pushes, they get on. But they have to push. It's not a disinterested process of the producers looking and seeing, is this the kind of thing that will appeal to our audience? Is this the kind of thing that will, you know, raise kind of an interesting or useful discussion in the community? Because, you know, I think even if you disagree with our documentary, and many people do, I think it's pretty hard to deny that the kind of discussion it provokes is useful. It's the kind of discussion that should go on about any large and powerful institution. But unfortunately, as it stands now, public broadcasting in the U.S. is not substantially different than the private media. And in fact, one of the segments in the documentary we show, a couple of them, show PBS doing substantially the same thing as the commercial media. In one case, we have Peter Grauman, who is an award-winning, I believe an Emmy award-winning journalist. He was doing a story on a nuclear waste dump sighting in Southern California. And, you know, the local farmers were against it. I think Native Americans were against it. Environmentalists were against it. And the reason they were is these things always leak.
Well, I think in that case, it was a fallacy to call it a facility because all it was a hole in the ground. And it was a dry hole, and that was the scientific improvement over the selection of a prior site, which was a wet hole. I mean, literally, this is what... And his story actually detailed what was the so-called facility. I mean, it burst the bubble of that technical jargon that really meant mm-hmm. absolutely the reverse of what opposite of what they were intending with this so-called site. And his story was edited to take the guts out of the story, to actually say what was going to be there. And the editor said that he had to shorten the story. So,
but so what got shortened was not just that the facility was a hole in the ground, but also that all the other quote-unquote facilities leaked.
Mm-hmm.
They leaked. And so all you saw was these, you know, guys in suits saying this is, you know, really scientific and good. And then you see a bunch of local people standing with signs and you know, they look like goofs because why are they, you know, they just must be stupid or uneducated. Why are they doing that?
NIMBYs. Yeah.
And so Grauman in the film says, you know, this is, I realize afterwards, they basically turned my story, which was, you know, trying to show both sides, into a pitch for the government and industry position. And PBS, we briefly show Jonathan Quitney. He was a Polk Award or some kind of award-winning journalist. That he had been at the Wall Street Journal. He had had something called the Quitney Report on PBS for a while. And he, you know, he did hard-hitting journalism. He showed U.S. involvement in the coup d'etat in Guatemala that terminated democracy there in the 50s and our assistance to basically a death squad operating government through the 80s. His show got cut, and he explained, you know, no corporation wanted to fund me, and PBS wasn't going to put me on unless I had a funder. And, you know, the average folk don't have money to pay for my show.
And I think that goes to the heart of PBS funding when Randy was saying that probably the majority of PBS funding for each individual station does come from listeners. But what that goes is that pays the rent or pays for the hard stuff, the facility stuff, as far as program, the corporations underwrite specific programs. And then that is the funding that becomes very ideological. What's going to advance their interests? They're not going to step forward and finance or corporate underwrite investigative journalists like Quitney. And so Quitney didn't have that funding source, so his show got cut off. And some of my friends said, well, you know, if you wanted to put this on PBS, why did you have two stories within your hour documentary that were critical of PBS, you know? And I don't think it made that much difference in the decision-making of an individual PBS station. What the taboo is that we were talking about corporate influence over self-censorship in the press that follows the corporate interest of the owners of that media outlet.
I'm delighted that some significant amount of the public is starting to view media policy and communications policy as important and something that requires citizen input. So that's step one, and that's starting to happen a little, which is great. What discourages me is the focus is on media consolidation, which I think is a bad thing. I mean, I think it's good that people understand that having one or two or three multinational corporations controlling almost all the media in the United States is bad. But it was not good when 50 of them did or 100 of them did, because when that was the case, you, in fact, our documentary shows the American media largely pre-1996, which was when, under so-called liberal Democrat Bill Clinton, the first deregulation of at least the first Telecommunications Act by Congress deregulating the mass media began and resulting in the major consolidations of media ownership that have occurred now. But even before then, you still had the same phenomena of corporate elites choosing who would have access to the media. And so if the media reform movement focuses all its attention on you know, returning things to the status quo ante back to 1995, we would still have a media that doesn't allow us to understand the causes and possible solutions of all kinds of problems, ranging from you know, why people can't have decent health care in the United States to why it seems we need to invade a third world country every 5 years. So to get to that problem, I think I am concerned that the discussion is not addressing the broader issue of how the public can own mass media and have access to it. And I'm not thinking by that of seizing control of the New York Times from the Sulzberger family or the corporation that owns it.
But that would be fun.
But what I am thinking is following what Justice Brandeis advised 80 years ago as the appropriate response to dangerous or inappropriate or untrue speech, which is more speech. We need to understand that to have democracy in the U.S., just like you can't have a poll tax to vote because it's unconscionable, because you can't have a democracy, we have to have public access, public endowment, an infrastructure for mass media. So, I mean, I've taken a proposal from an economist who happens to be my brother that he used in copyright and suggested we could do this for the mass media. And it's not the only option, but it just gives an idea of what I think we need to do. And that is to give every adult citizen in the U.S., you know, just like on your tax return, you can write off a few dollars for a political party. So there's public financing of the parties. I think every citizen can be given $150 to check off on a ballot or a form at the post office and dedicate that money to the nonprofit media organization of their choice. And if you did that, you would start empowering groups of 100, 1,000, 10,000 people to, you know, have their own websites, their own newsletters. And, you know, once you get up to 10 or 20,000 people doing that, you can have your own broadcast outlets. And you could even have your own paid staff. And I think that's the kind of thing we need to guarantee the public the ability to create or become their own trained journalist, trained media producer, to broaden the discussion in the U.S. So we get to talk about, that is by what I mean we, the majority of the public who aren't in the corporate elite, that we get to decide what we want to hear and speak about.
We have to look at media as a public resource, and certainly the airwaves are owned by the public. I mean, that's a shocking concept for some people. And we used to have kind of stipulations about public affairs. Now, you might not have liked how that was executed, but if we can continue to advance that discourse, saying like candidates should have, every candidate who's running for a major office gets free airtime. I mean, that would just be amazing to have open up the public discourse on stuff like that.
Yeah, it seems like the two are natural allies. The people's incensed about the current election system and problems we have there, and then the media as well. It seems like those are two issues that, no matter what your political views are, that people are getting riled up about that. So,
well, the one good thing about how this whole trend of market-driven news and bimbo news kind of has happened over the last 10 years is so many more people understand that they're not getting the information they need to be an engaged citizen. I mean, I think that's been a tremendous shift in the last 10 years. And the next question is, well, what can you do with that awareness?
Randy Baker and Beth Sanders, producers of Fear and Favor in the Newsroom, speaking with Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters Radio in Seattle. If you're interested in becoming involved in the movement for media reform, check out www.mediareform.net. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. America's foreign policy is inextricably linked with its domestic policy. In spite of political leaders' lip service to democracy, the actual effect of these policies is to suppress democracy. These policies maintain and strengthen a hierarchy designed to turn the haves into the have-it-alls, says our next speaker, Dr. Michael Parenti. The following talk was given in late October in Los Angeles.
I am very privileged to introduce our main speaker, Dr. Michael Parenti. He is a PhD from Yale, but he talks plain, I hear. Dr. Parenti's articles have appeared in numerous publications, including Covert Action Quarterly Magazine, New Political Science Monthly Review, The Humanist, Dollars and Cents, The Nation, Los Angeles Times, The New York Times. His commentaries are aired on radio stations, television talk shows, and cable community access stations in the United States, Canada, and abroad. His lectures and talks have been received with great enthusiasm and high interest. His books are available today, and he can autograph them for you. The latest, The Assassination of Julius Caesar, and the next most recent, The Terrorism Trap. His various works have been translated into 15 different languages. He's written 17 books and 250 articles. He's a world traveler who recently spoke in Belgrade, Hanoi, and Brussels, and South Orange, New Jersey, he says. He just told me that he was driving along in the car. He wasn't driving. He was the passenger. And he was holding up his cell phone, and he received a phone call from Radio Tehran. And they were asking him his assessment of the California election. Anyway, he wants to make sure that you know, if you don't know already, about his website, www.michaelparenti.org. I am very privileged on behalf of the People's Weekly World, because he has not spoken at a forum of ours for a number of years. This is the first time. And we are very, very fortunate to have Dr. Michael Parenti.
Thank you. But you know, it gets embarrassing when the applause you get before you speak are longer than the applause you get after you speak. I'm going to talk about U.S. globalism. I'm one of those people who believes that U.S. foreign policy is not stupid or confused, but it's very rational and it's very consistent. The history of U.S. policy, especially after World War II, but even before, is a history of bloody, repressive interventions. Most Americans would be shocked to hear about this. Most Americans believe that the United States is a force for good and virtue and democracy in the world. The gap, the difference between what Americans believe that U.S. leaders are doing in the world and what these U.S. leaders have actually been doing is one of the great propaganda achievements of the last century. The truth of the matter is, and it's not the United States. I may sometimes lapse and say the United States. Every time I say United States, I don't mean the United States, because we're the United States. I mean U.S. leaders. U.S. leaders profess a dedication to democracy, yet over the last 50 years, the U.S. national security state has been a key force in overthrowing reformist democratic governments in Guatemala, in Guyana, in the Dominican Republic, in Brazil, Chile, Uruguay, Syria, Indonesia under Sukarno, Greece twice, Argentina twice, Haiti, Bolivia, and other countries. It's a very incomplete list. Those are the ones I wrote down on the plane, just come to my head. and replaced them in each case with pro-capitalist military regimes that opened up their markets, resources, and cheap labor. By cheap labor, I mean unorganized labor. I mean underpaid labor. I mean labor that's intimidated by goon squads and death squads. Open them up to U.S. corporate investors on terms that are completely favorable to the investors. U.S. has been active in covert actions and proxy mercenary wars against popular revolutionary governments in Cuba, Angola, Mozambique, Ethiopia, Portugal, South Yemen, Nicaragua, Cambodia, East Timor, Western Sahara, and elsewhere. Another incomplete list. Against reformist governments in Egypt, Lebanon, Peru, Iran under Mossadegh, Syria, Zaire, Jamaica, the Fiji Islands, Afghanistan. U.S. forces with direct aggression and invasion have attacked just in recent years, in the last few decades, Vietnam, the Dominican Republic, North Korea, Laos, either with direct total invasion or aerial attack or both, North Korea, Laos, Cambodia, Yugoslavia, Lebanon, Grenada, Panama, Libya, Iraq twice, Somalia. Estimated 10,000 people killed in Somalia. You didn't hear about that 10,000, did you, when they did Black Hawk Down and they showed those 28 American boys killed, 28 who should have never been there. And we support our troops. We want to take them and bring them home. That's the real support. You saw that, all that fighting and all that. They didn't tell you that 10,000 Somalians were killed by U.S. jets and missiles and whatever else. Hundreds of thousands have been killed in Iraq. Tens of thousands died every week, all through the 12 years of sanctions. I visited Iraq in 99. When I was there, the bombings didn't start again. The bombings never stopped. The bombings were going on all through those 12 years, two, three times a week. Somebody were getting killed. In the short 7 days I was in Iraq in November 2000, a school was hit and four students were badly injured and two teachers were killed just in the week I was there by American bombs. And that stuff kept going on. 3 million were killed in Vietnam. 300,000 Vietnamese are still missing in action. We talk about our missing in action in Vietnam, which is, what, 1,200 now. Where are they? Where could they be? They have 300,000 missing, blown to pieces, gone, whatever. 500,000 in Laos were killed. And that's not the only victims. There's the victims who survived. They're the victims with shattered bodies, with shattered spirits and minds. They're the victims who lost everything, who spent a lifetime trying to recover from that. 300,000 killed in East Timor by that deranged murder machine known as the Indonesian Army, trained, equipped, paid, and advised by the Pentagon, the CIA, and the U.S. National Security State. 80,000 killed in El Salvador. Finally acknowledged, in the New York Times acknowledged, 30 years later, acknowledged that 205,000 were killed in Guatemala. And the president, our peerless leader of that time, slimebag Bill Clinton, goes down and says, I apologize. Oh, okay. Well, he apologized. That makes it all okay now. 205,000 killed by death squads, by extermination programs. 600 Mayan villages. 600 of these villages, every man, woman, and child in them killed by Rios Montt, General Rios Montt, protege of the School of the Americas, protege of the CIA. Over 1 million people killed in Mozambique. We never heard a word about this in the media because it was a CIA war. Over 2 million killed in Angola in a war that went on for 30 years, which didn't have to go on at all, except that UNITA was equipped and financed by the U.S. All through the Middle East, popular movements, workers' movements, unions, student movements, farmer collectives, all of them destroyed, shattered, battered down. In Turkey, in Iraq, Iran, Egypt, Syria, Saudi Arabia, Lebanon. Saudi Arabia, that obscenely filthy, rich, corrupt family wouldn't last 3 weeks if they didn't have U.S. guns behind them. The people of Saudi Arabia are ready to get rid of them. And we could go on. 21 countries in Africa that have had enormous amounts of U.S. arms, bribes, all of this. to put in the most retrograde, repressive, and corrupt rulers to destroy every popular movement, every democratic movement that emerges. These people are perfectly capable of democracy. These people are perfectly capable of viable production. These people are perfectly capable of organizing their markets and their labor. They're perfectly capable. They aren't allowed to do it. Because of this kind of destruction, the destruction of the economic infrastructure, the impoverishment of the people, the destruction of their future. You kill the future of a nation too. And anyone who dares to oppose it or question it is called a rogue state. Now, there's no rogue state. There's no terrorist movement. There's no axis of evil. There's no communist state that has this kind of record. There's no communist, red blood menace, you know, say what you want, Stalinist state that has anything like this record of aggression and destruction and murder and violation of international law. There just isn't. And I say the American people don't know it. All of this, by the way, is a matter of public record. It's not like I got some secret documents that just came into my hands that no one else has seen. It's all a matter of public record, but of course, there's some parts of the public record that get blasted across the media, and there are other parts of it that are thoroughly suppressed. Now, it's not enough to bemoan or denounce this. We also have to explain it. We have to explain why. Why is this happening? We will not convince our compatriots of the wrongful nature of this kind of policy unless we discuss the real intent and interest behind such policy. As long as they believe that this is being done to protect them from some threats out there, they will go along with it. They don't care if their leaders are rough. They don't care if their leaders violate international law. They want them to violate international law. They want them to act like thugs and gangsters. They want them to be tough and brutal and total and decisive. That's called strong leadership. That's called strong defense. When they are afraid, and that is what our leadership has done, is to conjure up fears that there's people out there going to get us. For a long time, it was the communist menace. The communists are going to get you. This is all because of communists. We have to do this. We have to support dictators because we've got to stop those communists. But a lot of these interventions came way before communism, and a lot more of them are happening more frequently, more bloodily, after communism. So it wasn't communism. That was one of the excuses. That was one of the bugaboos that they raised up. That was one of the fears they conjured up so that people will rally around the flag and will do what the leaders want. And we've got to speak to that fear and say, you have a false fear. There are things you really should be afraid of, and you're not afraid of it. Like poisoning the environment, like going and killing all these people, like putting your democracy at risk, like having your public treasure devoured by a rapacious military and a rapacious corporate America. Those are real things you should fear, and stop fearing some little country. One year it's Noriega, the next year it's Milosevic, the next year it's Gaddafi, the next year it's the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, the next year Saddam Hussein. Do you remember Gaddafi? I remember 1980s. In the 1980s, I was going around lecturing, and suddenly I hear people saying to me, Gaddafi, Gaddafi. Everybody was Gaddafiing. Gaddafi. What about Gaddafi? Gaddafi, 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 go and get your mama, Gaddafi. It was Gaddafi. I said, what Gaddafi, what? 2 months ago, you couldn't have found Libya on the map. Today, you're convinced that this guy, head of a country of 3 million people, with an army of 50,000, about the size of the LAPD, is a mortal threat to the safety of the United States of America, to the national security. And what was Gaddafi's real sin? I'll tell you what his real sin was, because that policy wasn't stupid when they targeted Gaddafi, and their animosity toward him is a very legitimate one. Here's what Gaddafi did. Gaddafi took a country that had a social structure like Saudi Arabia, where a few obscenely rich families ran the whole thing, got all the money from the oil, and the mass of people were poor. And what he did is he kicked those families out, he and his colonel's rebellion, and he started a forestation program. He planted millions of trees. He started health programs, education, school programs. For the first time in the history, the ordinary Libyans could go to school. That's what he was doing. And he nationalized the oil industry. And he took the earnings from the oil industry. He still sold it to the Western markets. What are they going to do with it? They can't drink it. They can't eat it. Sure, they are more than happy to sell it to the West. But they were getting the cut on it. And that money is what he used, and he gave that back to the people. And that's not what they like. Because the difference between the haves and the have-nots, I mean, the truth is, in the conflict between the haves and the have-nots, the haves are really the have-it-alls. They want it all, and they don't want to give a little bit here and a little there. The U.S. government, since World War II, has given away some $300 billion in military aid. Just think what $300 billion. That could solve all the budgetary crises of all the states in the Union right now. Just that amount. Aid to train, equip, and subsidize some 2.5 million troops and internal security forces in more than 80 countries. Not to defend these nations from outside invasion, but to protect ruling oligarchs and multinational corporate investors from the dangers of domestic anti-capitalist insurgency. How do we know that's true? Well, by observing, for instance, that with very few exceptions, there's no evidence that these various regimes have ever been threatened by attack from neighboring countries. So why are they building up these military forces? Why are they building up these security and police and paramilitary forces? It's not to make war or defend themselves from another country that's going to make war on them. It's to make war on their own people, to make war on their own working people. That's why. To protect those countries, to make the world safe for the Fortune 500. We also know that that's true because these friendly regimes invariably support economic systems that are subserviently integrated into a global system of transnational corporate domination, open to foreign penetration on terms that are totally favorable to transnational corporate investors. Third, there's clear evidence that the U.S.-supported military and security forces and death squads in these various countries have been used repeatedly to destroy popular reformist movements and insurgencies that advocate some kind of egalitarian redistribution of the resources of the society. So the struggle really is between those who think that the land, the labor, the natural resources, the markets, the technology, and the capital of the world in every country are there for the capital accumulation process and enrichment of the few, as opposed to those who think all those things are there for the needs and the social betterment of the many. And that's the basic struggle that goes on. The designated enemy, the demonized enemy, pumped up by the media, obligingly following the line the White House or the Pentagon puts out. The designated enemy can be a reformist, populist military government, as in Panama under Torrijo, and even under Noriega, or as in Egypt under Nasser, Peru under Velasco, Portugal after Salazar, when the army officers took over. It could be a Christian socialist government, as in Nicaragua under the Sandinistas. It could be a social democracy, popular front government, as in Chile under Allende, or Jamaica under Michael Manley, or Greece under Papandreou, the Dominican Republic under Juan Bosch. It could be a Marxist-Leninist government, as in Cuba, Vietnam, and North Korea, an Islamic revolutionary order, as in Libya under Gaddafi, or even a conservative militarist regime, as in Iraq under Saddam Hussein. In 1907, this is what Woodrow Wilson said. 1907, this was, I don't even think he was yet governor of New Jersey. Well, he certainly wasn't president. Maybe he was governor. He was a political science professor and president of Princeton for a while, and then governor of New Jersey, and then president of the United States. In 1907, Woodrow Wilson noted the role that's played by the capitalist state on behalf of private capital. I quote him. Since trade ignores national boundaries and the manufacturer insists on having the world as a market, the flag of his nation must follow him and the doors of the nations which are closed against him must be battered down. Concessions obtained by financiers must be safeguarded by ministers of state. Now, you hear that? That's a bourgeois college professor, president of the United States. If I just read that statement, if I said the financiers are serviced by the ministers of state, the ministers of state have to safeguard the financiers. You know what people say? Oh, you're Marxist. Oh, you're Marx. That's Marxist, you know. I hear that. I used to hear that all the time. When I was just getting myself radicalized, I used to hear that. I'd say things like, I think racism is actually, you say it's a failure of capitalism. I think it's a success of capitalism because it's used to divide the working class. It's used to suppress wages. And my colleagues would say, that's Marx. That's Marx. I said, Marx? I thought that was Parenti. I look in the mirror. I'd say things like, I don't think the police are neutral. I think why in a strike they side with the factory owners and not the workers? Why are they there defending the property and not the right of the worker who has an entitlement in the labor that he invests? And I say, well, that's Marx. That's Marx. I would hear this all the time. I say, I don't think U.S. policy is so innocent. We're out there helping the finance. Oh, that's Marx, they'd say all the time. And I say, boy, this guy Marx was really something. Here I am. I'm knocking myself out trying to make an analysis. Every time I come up with something, they give him the credit. That's pretty good. And then I realize something. That wasn't Marx. That wasn't Parenti. That was reality. That's what it was. And reality happens to be Marxist. So let's repeat that sentence and go on. Woodrow Wilson is talking. Concessions obtained by financiers must be safeguarded by ministers of state, even if the sovereignty of unwilling nations be outraged in the process. Colonies must be obtained or planted in order that no useful corner of the world may be overlooked or left unused. Now, that does sound like Marx, the manifesto. The same wording, he says, capitalism goes into every corner of the world to recreate it in its own image and put it to use for its capital accumulation process. Interesting. Sometimes the flag will go in before the dollars get there, and that's to create new opportunities. For instance, in 1919 in Haiti, the people started a popular rebellion and revolution. They actually built a popular militia to try to get the land back from the landowners, to try to get the big companies out of there and all that. The U.S. declared political instability. They have certain code words, they use. Political instability, undemocratic forces, we got to defend it. Political instability, and of course, racism gets used very handily here. You say, these little brown people in this little island have to learn self-governance. See, so we will have to go down and show them and at least bring law and order and stability back. So they went down just to take care of that. And they stayed a mere 19 years. And they killed 18,000 Haitians. And they also kicked out the French, German, and British companies, and U.S. companies came in. You see, capitalism not only fights the class war against its own laboring class, capital formations will often fight against each other and against other national capital formations. And, of course, the people pick up the tab on that, too. Yugoslavia is a great case in point. I have a book there called To Kill a Nation. Got any more copies of it? Good. See, here comes the infomercial now. We start. There it is. Okay. Yugoslavia was tolerated for quite some time as a breakaway country from the Eastern Bloc of nations, so-called Bloc of nations. But after 1990, the U.S. saw no reason to tolerate its existence anymore. I mean, here was a country, a rather large country right in Central Europe, which was not going the way of free market reforms as was happening in Russia, the Ukraine, Poland, and all over. They were not doing that usual thing. They were not, at first they weren't. Yugoslavia had an economy that was 80% state-owned still. Yugoslavia had a high standard of living and a high degree of economic equality. anybody could go to school to the highest level they want, and medical care was free. Yugoslavia showed no interest in joining the European Union, no interest at all in joining NATO. It had a productive industrial base, a successful auto industry. 80% of the Yugoslav auto market was sold by the Yugo. It had construction firms that competed quite successfully throughout, even in Western Europe. Now, when you destroy all that, you, of course, increase the value of your own capital. If I destroy your firms, I destroy your auto industry, I increase the value of my auto industry. If I destroy your agricultural base, I increase the value and open market opportunities for my agricultural base. And that's exactly what happened. German and U.S. agencies supported every retrograde secessionist and reactionary ethnic nationalist in Bosnia, in Croatia, and in Kosovo. And today, Yugoslavia has been broken up into a cluster of little right-wing republics where everything is privatized, everything's been deregulated, sold off to private investors at garage sale prices. That's the public capital of the people's labor is now given away to private investors, where the media have been taken over by rich private investors or conservatives. Pension funds have been plundered and disappeared. Public services have been shredded. I was just in Belgrade last March, and I was with a friend, and she said, well, I'm going to meet you later. It was a Saturday. I'm going to meet you later, but I'm going to a doctor's appointment. I said, what do you mean? It's 7 o'clock Saturday night. You're going to see a doctor? Who sees a doctor at 7 o'clock? She says, oh, here in Yugoslavia, the doctors will see you anytime you want because they're so desperate for patients. The public health services are broken down, so people are literally without, unless you can pay, are literally without services. And 7 was a convenient time for her, and the doctor said, okay, sure. There's inflation in Yugoslavia now. There's unemployment, poverty, suicide, prostitution. All of this has skyrocketed, and we hear next to nothing about it in the press. It's a free market paradise. It has been brought into the fold of the West. That's Yugoslavia today. And unfortunately, there were too many people on the left who supported that war and swallowed the official line. They swallowed the mass media line right down their throats. They thought they were fighting rape. They thought they were fighting a demon called Milosevic, and they didn't. And they were just ill-informed and taken in. It's much too bad. And I'm including some very notable progressive speakers who swallowed that line, including one who calls himself a pacifist. Okay. Now, some critics say, well, economic factors are not the motive behind intervention, because the intervention often costs more than the investment that the U.S. has there. For instance, in the Philippines, the U.S. has spent something like $7 billion in aid in the Philippines over the last 30, 40 years to protect a U.S. investment that's only about $3 billion. So it can't be economical. It's uneconomical to spending $7 billion to protect $3 billion. You know, Thorsten Veblen answered this question over 100 years ago. He said, what you're forgetting, not about the Philippines, but I'll bring him in now as a voice. What you're forgetting is that the people who pay the $7 billion are us, and the people who have the $3 billion are them. And they'll spend $7 of your money to protect $3 of theirs. They'll spend $20, $50, $100 of your money to protect $1 of their money. In fact, when it comes to protecting their money, your money is no object. Furthermore, it's not just to protect direct investments. It's to protect that whole global system. It's to destroy and suppress any country that tries an alternative, self-defining, self-developing system, that tries to get out from under that enormous global system. So it's not just direct investment. The two most dramatic examples of U.S. direct military intervention, there was very little U.S. money actually involved. In Soviet Russia in 1919, 1921, most of the capital was British and French.